Satishi Mahārāj. His divine grace, Abhaya Chananāda Bhaktivinanda Gosvāmī Mahāśīla Prabhupāda Ki Jai. ISKCON Founder Acharya Śrīla Prabhupāda Ki Jai. Ananda Koti Vaiṣṇava Vṛnda Ki Jai. Namacharya Śrīla Haridāsa Thakura Ki Jai. Vṛnda Kaho Śrī Kṛṣṇa Caitanya. Prabhu Nityananda Śrīdvaita Gadādhā Śrīvasati Gaura Bhakta Vṛnda Ki Jai. Śrī Radhakṛṣṇa Gopa Kavata Sāyam Kunda Radhakunda Giri Govardhan Ki Jai. Vṛndāvanam Turam Kijai, Navadip Dham Kijai, Jivanasami Kijai, Namai Kijai, Shimani Lassi Devi Kijai, Samaveda Bhakta Vrinda Kijai, Gaur Premananda. All glory is the assembled devotees. All glory is the assembled devotees. All glory is the assembled devotees. All glory is to Shri Guru and Gauranga Srila Prabhupada Kijai. Omaganatividandasya gananjana shlakaya chakshuran medikam yena tatrai shigurve namaha. I offer my respectful obeisances unto the lotus feet of my spiritual master, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Shinvopad, who so kindly opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge while I was blinded in the darkness of ignorance. So today we're going to talk about the events preceding the speaking of the Bhagavad Gita. And, of course, the Bhagavad Gita was spoken before the great war called the Mahabharata War. So, I think we're going to make this a little interactive just to keep everybody awake. It's not going to be just me speaking. So, I want to know, why is it called the Mahabharata War? Does anybody have any ideas?
It's a world war.
Yeah, but why Mahabharata? Why the word Mahabharata? Okay. Yeah, the Great War of Bharata Varsha. Very good. And why Bharat? Why is the world called Bharata Varsha? Here's another question. That's half of the question. Half of the answer. That's true. But there's another reason. Which Bharata Maharaj? That's a hint. Does anybody know of two Bharata Maharajas? Who are the two Bharata Maharajas? What's that? No. It's not named after Bharata, the brother of Lord Ram. There's a son of Shakuntala, and who's the king? Dushyanta. And who was the father of Shakuntala? Vishwamitra Muni, right. Okay, got it. Okay, so therefore, because many people, even if you're from India, you don't really know why it's called Bharata Varsha, you know, the land of India. Of course, Bharata Varsha previously was comprised of a much larger tract of land, in fact, the whole world. And you have characters from different parts of the world taking part in the Mahabharata War. For example, you have... not in the war precisely, but characters in the Mahabharata story. But you have Gandhari, for example, who came from where? Afghanistan. Kandahar. And she had a wonderful brother. What was her brother's name? Shakuni. He was a very pious person. Actually, Shakuni is considered an incarnation of Dwarpa, who was a... The reason I'm telling you is that it's actually a very important part of the story, who was a demigod. And there was another demigod who appeared on the wrong side of the battle of Kurukshetra. Who was that? Kali, but who did he appear as? Duryodhana. So the question is... Another question, but statement. The statement is, you know, why do you have demigods? Of course, Kali is called the worst of the demigods. That means, generally, they don't like it to associate with him. And Dwarpa is a little bit better. But the best, the demigods, of course, Lord Brahma, who is, and Lord Shiva, of course, who are pure devotees of the Lord. So the reason that these two demigods came down and they were on the wrong side, or it depends on your perspective, which is the wrong side. That's another point. Like we were talking about religion and heresy. Heresy means someone who deviates and has the wrong philosophy or religion. It just depends on what side you're on, whether you consider yourself to be heretic or to be part of the actual religion. Anyway, so as far as we are concerned, they were on the wrong side. As far as they were concerned, they were on the right side. So why would two demigods come down and be on the wrong side? Which is a very interesting question. The reason is, and I'll explain it because maybe it's too complex for all of you. The reason is that there was a war taking place, which continually takes place between the demons and the demigods on different planets. It's something like Star Wars. You know, the dark side of the force and the good guys. So and they fight in different places. Not only on the earth, but they fight in different planets, in the heavenly planets. Sometimes the demons, they try to take over the heavenly planets, and sometimes the demons are successful because the demigods neglect their spiritual master or they're negligent in some other way. And usually the demigods are successful. And sometimes the demons and the demigods make a truce and work together. What's an example of that? Churning the milk ocean. Isn't that interesting? Even like sworn enemies, if they have some common purpose, they can make a truce. And so you have the demons and the demigods churning the milk ocean. Of course, as soon as the results of churning the milk ocean were obtained, what were the results? The nectar, amrit. The demons stole it and didn't give it to the demigods, but the demigods had a trick up their shoulder, up there. And their trick was Mohini Murti, the female incarnation of the Supreme Personality of God, who tricked the demons to sacrificing the nectar, except they didn't trick one demon. What was the demon they didn't trick?
Rahu.
And Rahu had his head chopped off, and his head is still alive. Anyway, that's another story. So sometimes they make truces, sometimes they fight with each other. They're actually brothers, half-brothers. And their father is who? And who's the mother of the demons?
Diti.
Also, there's the Danavas, and Danu is the mother of the Danavas. And who is the mother of the demigods?
Aditi.
So they're actually cousin brothers. So you see that there is not just cousin, but half brothers. So you can see that this whole point of like intrafamilial fighting is coming down since the beginning of the universe, basically. So don't worry if you fight with some of your relatives. There's a whole disciple of succession of that. And there's also mother-in-law stories, too, which I'm not going to get into. But anyway. So getting back to the story of the Mahabharata, which hopefully I get to in this class. They're fighting, and so the demons, there's another part of the story, too, before I get to the Mahabharata. Sometimes the demons, in order to escape from the demigods, they go down into the ocean. And the demigods have a hard time finding the demons in the ocean because one of the demigods, his name is Agni, and he has a real problem with going into water. Because Agni is the god of fire. And you put fire in water, it's a mess. And so the demigods just didn't know what to do. So who did they call for? They called for a sage. And the sage's name was Agastyamuni. And they said to this sage, and this sage had great mystic power, and power of digestion too. They said to the sage, you should actually drink up all the ocean. And so the sage said, no problem. And he drank up all the ocean, and the demigods attacked the demons. And then they said to the sage, you should let the water out now. And he said, no, he burped. He said, no, I can't. I digested all the water. Salt water. Can you imagine? Salt water usually kills people if they drink a little bit, what to speak of a whole ocean full. So, anyway, that's another story of demigods fighting the demons. So in this particular story related to the Mahabharata, the demons had taken shelter on the earth planet. And in the way they took shelter was quite interesting. They were born in different Kshatriya families. Kshatriya means like the martial class, the administrators of society, the kings, presidents, prime ministers, stuff like that, leaders of society. And so there were a whole bunch of them. I mean, literally millions of them. So the question was, you know, how to deal with all these demons on the earth planet. And the earth was actually overburdened by all these demons. And like nowadays, of course, I'm not going to point out any particular demon. When we use the word demon, let's be more precise. We don't mean someone who looks like the devil with a forked tail and horns on his head and everything like that. Some of the demons were quite handsome, attractive, well-mannered, knew how to perform Vedic sacrifices. Quite nice chaps in many ways. But there's one quality they had, which is described in the Gita, that distinguishes them from devotees or demigods. Pravatim cha nivratim cha janana vidur asura. The Gita tells us they basically didn't know what to do in terms of God. They didn't know positive or negative injunctions, what to do, what not to do. Everything was based upon their mental speculation. In other words, they don't accept that there's a supreme personality of God, and they don't certainly don't accept that the goal of life is to worship God. That's what distinguishes a demon from a demigod or a godly person from an ungodly person. Not that they go around killing a lot of people. Some demons do. But what really distinguishes them is the belief in God and the following God's injunctions. Because many of these personalities, like I said before, the demons, they were quite sophisticated people. I mean, Ravana was so expert in chanting Vedic mantras that, you know, sometimes Brahmanas would call him. Of course, he was born in a Brahminical family. At least his father was Brahminical. That he would be called to help with the pronunciation of the Vedic mantras. He was quite an educated person. Okay, so the demons took birth on earth in, you know, kingly families. The earth was overburdened, and the earth made a lot of complaints because Bhumi is a person. The earth is a person. Actually, in the West, I think it's called the Gaia hypothesis, where you understand that the earth, it is a person. It's a big, the earth has a big body, but the earth, being a demigod, can manifest herself. It's like we say Mother Earth, not Father Earth. The earth can manifest herself as a female. I mean, that's one of her forms. So she went to Lord Brahma and made a complaint. Because Lord Brahma is in charge of the whole universe. He's the original person born from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Garbha Dakshaya Vishnu. And she went to Lord Brahma and said, I'm overburdened. I mean, I don't mind if there's billions and billions of devotees, but even one demon is too much for me. And the earth was filled with these demons. And Lord Brahma, of course, he went to the shore of the ocean of milk and meditated on the Supreme Lord. And then he was told by the Supreme Personality of God through a message that he should arrange that the demigods that he was going to take birth, Lord Vishnu was going to take birth on the earth planet, and he should arrange that the demigods would also come down to the earth planet to take birth. So this is all preceding the advent of the Lord and, of course, the whole story of the Mahabharata. So in other words, it was an interplanetary war, and the strategy was planned out by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Try to understand that. So it was necessary to have a big war in those cases. Now, we're not in favor of war, except in the case where it's protecting the people. And so this war was to protect the populace. That's what a Kshatriya does. Now, the word Kshatriya means he who protects others from harm. So it was necessary to protect the earth planet, first of all, and to protect the populace, and to lead them in the proper way to get rid of these personalities who were impeding not only the spiritual progress, but even the material progress of people on the earth. So that was the purpose of the war. So, therefore, there was a whole plan. Let's like if you have any war. There's a strategy. It's not that you just grab your weapons and run in like Rambo. No, people have to, you're watching too many films, you know, you think someone just grabs the machine guns and starts shooting, boom, 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 and he doesn't even get hurt. I mean, if you watch movies, you see people fall off of buildings that are 10 stories high, and they walk away. But that's not life. It's like even if you join the Army or the Navy or any armed forces in the United States, you go to a college, university, and you learn strategy. I mean, you can study the strategies of World War II, the strategies of different wars that have occurred. You know, you have General Patton, for example. Some of you may have heard of him. But in any case, you study. They're quite intelligent people. General Eisenhower. Quite intelligent strategies in different formations. The Mahabharata also talks about formations. You know, you have the chakra formation and different, the pincer formation. And so that's what you study when you go to military school. In addition to other things, of course. So Krishna had to have a strategy. He didn't have to. He could have wiped everybody out personally, that's true. But Krishna wanted to do it in a very strategic fashion, and he wanted his devotees to do it too. And he wanted to glorify his devotees. He wanted to glorify his devotees by showing how his devotees were willing to surrender everything. As Krishna says in the Gita, 18th chapter, Sarva Dharmam Parichaya Mamekam Sharanam Vraja. I mean, that's the principle of religion. Give up all varieties of religiosity, mundane religiosity, not spiritual religiosity. It's not that you give up being a religious person and say, I'm surrendering to Krishna. That's a misunderstanding of that particular verse in the Bhagavad Gita. But Krishna wanted to show that by this whole pastime of the Mahabharata, how his devotees were willing to sacrifice everything, you know, their families, everything in order to please him, in order to carry out their religious functions, their spiritual functions. Really, that's one of the underlying messages of the whole Mahabharata. You know, you have Arjuna, who was unwilling at the beginning of the Gita. He said, you know, how can I enjoy without my family? I mean, who's going to come to the banquets? Right? You know, it's better to die. I'm ready to throw down my weapons. And Krishna just taught him renunciation. Real renunciation means to do what pleases Krishna. People have this misunderstanding of what renunciation is. They think it's someone, as Krishna says, paraphrases in the Gita, he says, someone who lights no fire, does no work. He's very renounced. But that's not actually renunciation. Real renunciation means to accept everything that Krishna wants and reject everything that Krishna doesn't want. Very simple. So someone can be married with a family, a businessman, and be more renounced than a sannyasi who is simply sitting and staring at his navel. I didn't say all sannyasis do that. But you know, you find people do that, or covered with ashes or something like that. I mean, the real renunciation is even to renounce what you want to do, because many people like to just sit in the forest and stare. I don't know why, but anyway. You know, but to renounce what you want. Like Arjuna, he wanted to go to the forest and become like a sannyasi, give it all up. This is too much trouble, you know, this is too much bigger conflict for me, Krishna. You know, on one hand you tell me to fight, and the other hand there's all these relatives there, and people are gonna die, and then he has so many excuses, and he was caught in the horns of a dilemma, as they say. So what do people do when they're caught in the horns of a dilemma? They flee. It's called fight or flight. It's an animal thing. Isn't it? When animals are confronted with some threat, they either fight or run away. Right? So sometimes we're caught in a conflict. We have two opposing instructions. And we just want to run away to Govardhan and just chant Hare Krishna and say, goodbye, cruel world. Isn't it? But that's an animal response. Actually, that's a mode of passion response, Krishna says in the Gita. That's renunciation in the mode of passion. Actually, I'm bringing a little Gita knowledge into the class, too. So the real renunciation is, whether you feel like it or not, if God wants it, if God says jump, instead of saying why, you say how high. Ours is not to reason why. Anyway, so this is actually one of the lessons from the Mahabharata, perhaps the most important lesson. That, you know, what God's instruction is, following God's instruction is the supreme renunciation. So let's get to the Mahabharata story if we actually have time. So here's some of the events. I don't know how much time I'll have to tell the story, but once upon a time, Krishna drew up this whole plan how to get rid of the demons. And so his plan actually started several generations before the Mahabharata war. You know, really careful planning. So he arranged, I mean, this is like Yogamaya. Let me try to explain something. Like, you find in the Mahabharata people getting cursed, thrown out of heaven, having their children killed, and you think this, wow, what's going on? But this is Krishna's Yogamaya arranging the scene for what he wants to accomplish. And it's Krishna's devotees who are playing this, like you have Grandfather Bhishma, who was a pure devotee as a Mahajan. You have Arjuna, who is a pure devotee. He's an eternal associate of Krishna. Krishna says to Arjuna in the Gita, many, many births, both you and I have passed. I can remember all of them. You can't, because you're changing your body. And Krishna indicates that Arjuna was present when Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita millions of years before the Mahabharata war. So here is someone who's eternally with Krishna. I mean, many of the personalities are eternal associates of Krishna, like Arjuna, Yudhisthira, etc., like that. And so this is like a traveling play where the eternal associates of Krishna, they appear when Krishna appears to perform different pastimes with Krishna. And also, in addition to all this Paritranaya, Sadhana, Vinishanaya, Dushkutam, which is saying, you know, Krishna planned the whole strategy out, Krishna is enjoying the different rasas. That means the tastes from the relationships and from the activities, too. Because God is not simply, let's say, some stereotype, like a stereotyped understanding of God, that he just sits on a throne and all he does is pass judgment on people all day long. That would be a boring job. You know, Krishna has every single tendency that anyone else has, in pure form, of course. Krishna is the source of everything. Aham sarvasya prabhu matat sarvam pravartate. Just like we may like some competitive sports or fighting, Krishna likes that too. He's God. I mean, why deny God something that we have? You know, say, oh, you say, you have a wife? Why can't God have a wife? You say, no, that's not possible. Why do you have a girlfriend? Of course, you better not have a girlfriend. But sorry, this is not the Krishna West, don't worry. So why can't Krishna have a girl? Why can't Krishna have, like, thousands or millions of girlfriends? Why can't Krishna have 16,108 wives? Right? What's the problem? So the point I'm making is that Krishna has, he enjoys different things. It's like you may want to watch a football game. Or in India, it's what? Cricket. Cricket, you know. I mean, for example, I was in Fiji one time and the World Cup, that's soccer, of course. Soccer, was being played in England. And it was the middle of the night and I was sleeping and I heard all the devotees, you know, cheer. Say, Hari Bol, in the middle of the night. And I thought, wow, these are good devotees. All night, kirtan, you know, immersed in Krishna's names. Wow. And I asked, wow. The next morning I said, boy, you really had a good time. He said, yes, it was the World Cup. So you enjoy that. And I know on a Sunday when there's a big thing on TV, you know, some game or something like that, that very few people come to the temple. I mean, it's worse than when it's icy and raining. So don't think that doesn't happen in the spiritual world. No, not TV. Not, they don't avoid going to the temple. But Krishna does that too. Krishna has games. Krishna, you know, plays cops and robbers, or bad guys and good guys. And so part of this whole thing is an elaborate play for Krishna's enjoyment. It's just so, no Krishna, because otherwise all this killing is already going on without a Mahabharata war. I mean, the time factor, as Krishna shows in the Gita, when he's shown the universal form, Krishna says, Kalo Asmi, I am time, Richu Sarva Harash Chaham. Right? I am all devouring death. So everyone's dying anyway. You don't need a war. Death rate is 100%, it's always been 100%. No matter what you do about it, with a war, without a war. Whether you die in a car accident, or you die because you ate too much, or you die, that's a commercial announcement. So, the wrong things. Or you die because of old age. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. So Krishna doesn't need the war to kill everybody. But it's part of his dramatic performance. I mean, that's one way of looking at the Mahabharata war. That it's chivalry. Like, we talk about there's five direct rasas that people have. You understand? Like, you can be a passive adorer, or you can adore someone passively. You can serve them. You can be their friend. You can be their parent. You can be their lover. I mean, these are basic relationships you have, even in this world. And so Krishna has those relationships, but these relationships are sometimes flavored with different spices. And by spices, I mean like chivalry, humor. Like sometimes one of Krishna's coward boys, he wants to eat a laddu and says, Krishna says, close your eyes, open your mouth. And he pops a flower in the guy's mouth. Isn't it? Can you imagine that? So the Krishna's very humorous. And he's very tricky. And he likes to make his girlfriends angry sometimes. Sometimes he says to Srimati Radharani, I don't know how she got in the Mahabharata war. But anyway, sometimes he says to Srimati Radharani, your face is just like Chandravali. Referring to her competitor. Then Krishna means moon, but he mispronounces, because Chandra means moon. So he adds the avali at the end, like many moons. That's what Chandravali means. So, and then she gets so angry that she said, I don't want to see you anymore. And Krishna really enjoys that. I mean, it's like, just like in a normal relationship between men and women. Sometimes the man and the woman, they're teasing each other, right? And Krishna tells his wife sometimes, you should get a divorce. He said that to Rukmini. You know, they had grandchildren, probably great-grandchildren by that time. And he said to Rukmini, you married the wrong guy. You know, I'm just not qualified. You should marry someone. You know, you're still young, because she remained young. She had a benediction. She always looked young. And so, you know, he expected her to get angry, but instead she fainted. Because she was more of a submissive wife. Whereas Satyabhama would have never reacted like that. So, Krishna enjoys these things. I mean, it's... Somehow or other, this is the whole Mahabharata story is Krishna's exchanging different rasas with different people. You know, chivalry, bewilderment, ghastliness, that's another indirect rasa. And there's humor there. And so it's, one should look at the Mahabharata like that too. Not simply some mundane story where, you know, the good guys fighting the bad guys and you can't figure out who's good and who's bad. Sometimes in the Western world, they portray the Mahabharata like that. It is the good guys fighting the bad guys. And some of the bad guys are actually good guys, but they got influenced by the bad guys. I mean, that's even more intense. I mean, there's a lot of little lessons there. I mean, for example, Grandfather Bhishma, I mean, he's a great guy. Guy, sorry for the nomenclature. But he's a great devotee. And, you know, let's speak of Drona and Kripacharya. But what happens, this is one story which I'll tell, it leads up to the Mahabharata. What happened is that they were influenced by demoniac forces. One time, Duryodhana, he's the bad guy, those of you who don't know. Duryodhana was trying to make fun of the Pandavas. The Pandavas were by some lake, and they were in exile, of course. And Duryodhana wanted to show off all of his opulences because he had in charge of the kingdom. He was in charge of the kingdom. So he came to the lake, but he didn't understand that that lake was controlled by the Gandharvas. And the Gandharvas got so upset with Duryodhana, they kidnapped him. And they held him captive. And he had to be rescued by the Pandavas. This is one of the stories in Mahabharata. They have to be rescued by the Pandavas. And so the Pandavas rescued, and Duryodhana was so incensed, I mean so upset, so depressed, he got ready to commit suicide. He just was sitting down, fasting till death. But then the demons came, you know, some subtle demons, and they assured him, don't worry, we're going to influence these personalities like Grandfather Bhishma, Dronacharya, and Kripacharya, and make them fight completely with all their enthusiasm on your side. And so Duryodhana just like jumped up, said Hari Bol, or whatever he said, and he felt renewed strength at that point. And the way that they were influenced, this is an interesting lesson. The way they were influenced was that they, just like they say, the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. You've heard that expression before?
Yeah.
And you are what you eat. So this is something Prabhupada taught us, practically in the first days of the Hare Krishna movement, that when you eat food that is cooked by someone with bad consciousness, the mind becomes wicked. Everybody who's been a member of the movement for some time knows this, that a person's consciousness enters into the food, especially grains, enters into the food, and somehow whether it affects you, because according to the Ayurveda, when you eat food, it's eventually transformed through several stages into the blood, and the blood carries the consciousness. So it's like getting a transfusion from someone, ultimately. I mean, maybe not exactly the same, but I'm just drawing parallels between the two things. So therefore, Duryodhana's kitchen, and certainly if Duryodhana was bad, his cook was probably worse. And so he was, Grandfather Bhishma, Dronacharya, Kripacharya, they were eating food cooked in Duryodhana's kitchen. And so their mind became influenced by the karma and the bad consciousness that was attached to that food. And as a result, they fought on the wrong side. You know, in the name of keeping their vows, like Grandfather Bhishma, or their allegiances, like Kripacharya and Dronacharya, they fought on the wrong side. So you see that happening too. I mean, for example, when Krishna came to try to make peace between the Kurus and Pandavas, Krishna refused to eat that food. Duryodhana offered it to him. He said, look, please come and take dinner and then we'll talk about business later on. And Krishna said, no, I'm not going to eat with you unless you make a deal. And so Krishna ate very simple food at whose house? Madhura's house. Just porridge, it's described. So Krishna was setting an example there of, you know, really how you have to be careful, or else your mind can become influenced, and any of us can become influenced. And become, I mean, Grandfather Bhishma can become influenced, any of us can become influenced. So there's another lesson there in the Mahabharata, how by the influence, if we're not careful, then we can be on the wrong side. So many, many different lessons like that. So Krishna, it's Krishna's enjoying, Krishna's teaching lessons. Oh, do I have time to continue? Anyway, this is some of the background. I don't think I'll tell any of the stories because I don't think we have much time. Do we have a little time? How much time have we been going for? 34 minutes already. It's quite a bit. So, any questions? Unless you want me to tell more stories.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, we'll start from the beginning. We'll see how far we get. Once upon a time, there was a king. His name was Mahavish. And because he had performed so many horse sacrifices, 1,000 in fact, he went to heaven. And he went to heaven, and he was enjoying seeing the dancing girls. This is all part of Krishna's plan. It's really amazing how Krishna starts in the beginning. Like, you'll hear how it's cursed, but Krishna wanted it to happen. So he was enjoying, you know, there was a dancing girl performance there. Whatever. Bart Nachum or some other dance like that. And so he was watching. And also there was one of the girls wasn't a dancer there. Her name was Ganga Devi. And there was some breeze in the heavenly planets. And as a result, part of her dress got blown upwards. And he just stared. Like that. You know, just stare. What? Look at her. And you know, and obviously, if something like that happens, you just, like someone who is, you know, common sense, they'll just look the other way. Like, I mean, I remember in Kirtan one time, someone's dhoti fell off. This happened. This is a funny story. It happened in Fiji. The devotee's name was Hari Nam. He was really into kirtan, and Jamal Krishnamurti was there, and they were chanting, and he got so enthusiastic, and the dhoti just fell off, and everyone looked the other way. But Jamal Krishnamurti said to him, he was the only one who really could say to him, "Your dhoti fell off." I mean, you know you're immersed in the holy names. When you're not aware of that. So in this particular case, let's go back to the Mahabharata. This Mahavishi just kept looking at her. And Lord Brahma got so angry with Mahavishi, he said, "You know, I curse you to take birth in the earth planet. Just a regular earthling." And Mahavish was just like really, really upset with it. But Ganga Devi sort of appreciated the attention. And she actually was in love with him somehow or other. And later on, she agreed to go down to the earth planet for another reason. And the reason was that there were these Vashus who were heavenly people, very intelligent people. And they had committed a great offense against this sage Vashishta by stealing his cow. And so they were cursed to come down to the earth planet. But they didn't want to have just an ordinary mother. So they went to Ganga Devi and said, "You know, you should go down and be our mother." And Ganga Devi was already thinking of going down there because she was in love with Mahavish. And so she went down to the earth planet. And she agreed to be the mother of the Vashus who were cursed to take birth on the earth planet. And the Vashus had also previously apologized to Vashishtha Muni. And Vashishtha Muni said, "All right, because really you were just influenced by your older brother, Jao. He's the one who has to live a long life. The rest of you can just like take birth and get out of there right away." So it's all Krishna's plan, like I said. So then what happened is that, let's say, Mahavish, he took birth as a Shantanu. And his father's name is Pratipa. And Pratipa was going by the Ganges one day and he saw this beautiful girl who was Ganga Devi. And Pratipa, she sat on his left thigh, which means daughter-in-law. So he said, "I accept you as my daughter-in-law. I don't accept you as a wife." So that was already preordained. Then later on, Shantanu comes around the Ganges and he sees this beautiful girl, the personification of the Ganges, and he's just like overwhelmed because this is from past birth. Talk about deja vu. You know, sometimes people get married and say, well, we've been married for many lifetimes. Maybe. Or maybe they were enemies last time. Who knows? But in any case, sometimes it happens, like your father said that. So in any case, you recognize someone from past life, right? There's immediate recognition. Wow, buddy Dave, I know you're from past life. So sometimes, you know, it's good, you know, deja vu, I've been there before, or recognition, or you hear some music and it sounds very familiar, or you're attracted to a particular culture, like you, somehow or other you like Indonesian music and you're born in America, you know, how did that happen? Or Rastafarian music, or whatever. And it happens, because it's last life. We have natural attractions to things because of last life. So this happened between immediate. It was love at first sight, but it really wasn't first sight. It was from the past. And so immediately Shantanu says, without wasting much time, will you marry me? Because the kings were like that. They didn't usually wait to do an astrological calculation. They were quite romantic. In other words, you know, I'm Tarzan, you Jane, like that. Something like that. You know, they're very romantic, but they want to do it in a dharmic way. It's not that, you know, they just like do it in a dharmic way. They want to have get married. Of course, there's many systems of marriage there in the Vedic literature. There's marriage even just by exchanging garlands. That's called Gandharva rite. There's marriage by kidnapping the girl. It's bona fide. Krishna did it. Don't you try it. But Krishna did it. Krishna kidnapped Rukmini. Arjuna kidnapped who? Subhadra. That's romantic. I mean, then your wife remembers that. Here's pictures of me being kidnapped. Isn't it? What happened to our love? You used to kidnap me. And now you're running away from me. So getting back to the story of Shantanu. So Shantanu said to her immediately, we have to get married. You know, first he asked, are you married? Are you engaged? And she said, no. And she said, all right, I'll marry you. It is preordained. But there's a prenuptial agreement, like we have nowadays. You know, you get the house, I get the dog. So let's have a prenuptial agreement. That means before marriage you make a signed agreement, a legal agreement, that you will never, never argue with me, disagree with anything I do, speak a harsh word to me, do anything disagreeable that I don't like. And he was in love, you know, obviously. When you're in love, you forget about common sense. Isn't it? Doesn't that normally happen, you know? I don't know, I'm a sannyasi. But anyway, so he was in love. And he says, sure, this is whatever you say. How could I ever disagree with you? You're so pretty, I would never disagree with you. I mean, logic. You're pretty, I would never disagree with you. Hey, talk about the heights of illogic, right? So he signs on the dotted line. They get married, and she proceeds to kill each child, drown each child right after the child's born. And of course, this was preordained and pre-agreed upon, because these were the vasus who were supposed to go right back to the heavenly planets. They didn't want to hang around the earth planet. So it's not that the babies didn't want to die. They wanted to get out of here, because there's a lot more pleasure in the heavenly planets. Mangoes are as big as this building. There's rivers of mango juice. Mangoes, you can see I like mangoes. But mangoes don't have any peel on them or pit on them. And it's amazing up there. It's amazing. That's why so many people want to go to Swarga, right? To heaven. It's temporary, but amazing. So they wanted to get back. So she keeps killing one kid after another. He's just holding his mouth, biting his teeth. Oh my God, what did I promise? And then one after another, finally comes to the eighth, and he can't hold himself back any longer. And he says, "Stop!" And she says, "You broke your agreement. I'm out of here. And I'm taking the kid with me." And so that's basically what happened. That was Bhishma. He wasn't grandfather at that time. But that's how Bhishma, you know, Bhishma actually was born. And he is the Vasujal was his original name in the heavenly planets. And so he was trained up by his mother and also by other people in the heavenly planets to be a great soldier. He could stop the flow of the Ganges River. You know, one time Shantanu came and he found his son. His son had stopped the flow of the Ganges River just with arrows. You know, arrows imbued with different mantras. And then he took Bhishma back as his son. Devavrata, actually, that Devavrata Bhishma with different names. So anyway, so just one more romantic story before we end. So this is that's the appearance of Bhishma. So then what happened is that Shantanu was romantic in many different ways, not only with Ganga Devi. He also fell in love with a girl named Satyavati. And Satyavati was actually the daughter of a king named Vasu. But she came out of a fish, but there's a long story about that, which I'm not going to tell right now. But so anyway, so because she came out of a fish, she was a fisherman's daughter. She was discovered by the fishermen. She was fisherman's daughter. The fishermen adopted her. And she had the job of ferrying people across the river. And she also, because she came out of a fish, she smelled like a fish market. I mean, that's the Mahabharata story. Exactly what the Mahabharata says. It smells very bad, like a fish. Until she met Parashara Muni. This happened sometime before Shantanu. Parashara Muni met her, and he knew that she was supposed to be the mother of Vyasadeva. So he proposed to her in the middle of the sea, in the middle of the lake, river. And she said, "This is not the best place." And he created a fog, and he enabled her to regain her virginity at that particular point. And this was a secret, that she was the mother of Vyasadeva. And Vyasadeva said, "Whenever you want me, Mom, I'll come." So later on, this is very important, that Vyasadeva came any time that she called for him. So, but for all intents and purposes, she hadn't been married, and she was fair. She, at that point, after being with Parashara Muni, he gave her the benediction that you would be called Ganda. What is the rest of the name there? Anyway, you have a good smell for 8 miles. Instead of it, there's a Sanskrit word for it, I forget right now. No, Ganda. What's the Sanskrit word for 8 miles? Yojana. Ganda Yojana was her name at that point. Ganda Yojana. So she had such a fantastic smell that anybody in 8 miles would faint. So these are amazing stories. It's Mahabharata. So anyway, so. But it's all Krishna's dramatic play. That's what I want to explain. It's just, when Krishna does things, he does things in a big way. You know, when Krishna becomes a tortoise, it's a big tortoise. And he's all able to support the Mandara Hill. When Krishna becomes a lion, half man, half lion, ferocious, he's not just like, you know, a very shy lion. Not the Lion and the Wizard of Oz, you know. And Krishna does things in a big way. So, anyway, so then Shantanu comes around, and he sees her, smells her, and it's also love for him. So he proposes to her. Like I said, Kshatriyas do that. And she says, "Well, I got to speak to my father first." And her father, the father is actually called Matsya Raj, which means the king of the fishermen. Or, in English, it's kingfish. So he was, And so he went to the father, and the father said, no, there's a problem with my daughter, Satyavati, marrying you. One problem is that I want her son to be the king. And by that time, Shantanu had already promised to Bhishma that he would be the next king, called the Yuvaraj. He would be the next king. So Shantanu thought, I can't do it. I can't take Bhishma's inheritance away from him. And Shantanu went into a deep depression. At that time, there were no psychologists. So Shantanu went into a deep depression because he couldn't marry this girl. He had promised Bhishma that he would be the next king. And so basically, Shantanu disappeared. He was just like crying in his room for days and days and weeks. You know, well, my true love, I cannot have her. I mean, this is passion. It's almost like some Bollywood movie, isn't it? But that's where Bollywood movies come from. They come from the past. They're perverted reflections of the pastimes of Krishna. You see? Like you have people dancing with a large crowd in a Bollywood movie. That's a perverted reflection of the Rasa dance. Of course, in the Bollywood movie, they're dancing at the Bombay Railway Station instead of in the forest of Vrindavan. Right? Like that Slumdog Millionaire was like that. So Bhishma eventually discovers that his father is so depressed, and he finds out the reason. The father's assistant, the prime minister, tells him. And then he goes to the fisherman, and he says to the fisherman, please give your daughter to my father. And the fisherman says, but basically her child has to become the king. And Bhishma says, okay, I renounce kingship. And then the fisherman says, but you may have a child who fights with her child. And Bhishma says, I renounce getting married. Akanda Brahmachari become a... And that, at that time, flowers came from the heavenly planets. And then Bhishma took Satyavati back to his father. The best gift you could give your father. He took Keshe, and they got married. I can't go through the whole story, obviously. I mean, we'd be here all night. But this is just a few more details. They got married, and they had two children. Chichangada and Vichitravirya. They had two children, but Chichangada got killed because he was fighting with a Gandharva of the same name. And so Vichitravirya was the only son left. And Vichitravirya, he wanted Bhishma to find a wife for him. So he sent his half-brother. Bhishma said, you better get me a wife. So Bhishma... It's good having a brother like that. So Bhishma, incidentally, he never got married, but he was always arranging marriages. Which is interesting. He even arranged Pandu to marry Madhuri. So he was arranging marriages, arranging, you know, children to be brought up and everything like that. So he was fully involved in household life in spite of not being married. So it was a good lesson for you. So what happened is that Bhishma, he went and he kidnapped three girls, you know, the king of Kashi's daughters, Amba, Ambalika, and Ambika. And he kidnapped them for Vichitravirya, and he brought them back to Vichitravirya, but Amba actually revealed to him that she was in love with someone else, Shalvaraj, and so he sent her back. Later on, she was rejected by Shalva, and then she came back, and she was rejected by Bhishma, and to make a long story short, she took a vow to kill Bhishma, and later on she took birth as Shikhandi, and was actually instrumental in the killing of Grandfather Bhishma, or at least the disabling of Grandfather Bhishma on the bed of arrows. So a lot of these important stories leading up to the Mahabharata war. And so then Vichitravirya, he has these two girls and he's in love too. Runs in the family. He's in love with these two girls and he's so much in love that he forgets about taking care of his own health. And he dies without any children. And so at that time, Satyavati was all worried about what are we going to do, carry on the dynasty. So she called for Bhishma and she said, Bhishma, you know, Because at that time, like, the brother could have relationship with the, if his brother died or something like that, just to carry on the dynasty, this was a Kshatriya point. And so Bhishma said, no, I'm a brahmacharya. I took a vow to be brahmacharya my whole life. I'm having nothing to do with this. And so then she thought for a few minutes. She said, well, I have a son from previously. Who was that son's name? Does anyone remember? Vyasadeva. I'll call him. And so Vyasadeva comes as soon as his mother calls him. And then he goes to the first girl, Ambika. And Vyasadeva at that point had been meditating for a long time in the forest. So he, you know, his hair was all matted. At that time they matted hair by putting tree sap in the hair. It was really, really messy. You know, tree sap. Even when Lord Ramchandra went to the forest, he put tree sap in the hair. And one of the reasons for that is an austerity. And you can't comb it, actually, when you have tree sap in the hair. And so combing hair for Kshatriya and for ladies is actually something that's considered, like, desirable. For some reason or other. So Vyasadeva appears that he'd been doing austerity. He was very thin. He was gaunt. And for those who couldn't appreciate his spiritual qualities, it was frightening. So he was supposed to have a relationship with this girl, Ambika, whose husband had died, Richard Treveria died. And he went in to see Ambika. And Ambika, upon looking at him, actually she closed her eyes. She couldn't bear the way he looked. And as a result, she had a son who was born blind. And that was Dhritarashtra. And so Ambalika was warned about this whole thing. You better keep your eyes open. You know, you don't want a blind kid either. So she was pre-warned. So she thought, you know, I'm going to keep my eyes open no matter what. So Vyasadeva walks in. This is all Mahabharata. Vyasadeva walks in, and she said, I got to keep my eyes open, but this is too much. And she turns white. And as a result, Pandu was born, who has problems with his health, and he's white, you know, very, very white complexion. So Pandu was born. And then Satyavati is thinking, you know, I want someone else. You know, two is all right, but, you know, we just, to protect the dynasty, we need more children. So she called for Ambika again, and she said, all right, you got to see Vyasadeva again. And Ambika thought, no way. No way, I mean, this is too much. So she agreed, but she didn't agree. In other words, she said yes. But then she brought her maidservant in to see Vyasadeva. And the maidservant was a great pure devotee to the Lord, and she recognized Vyasadeva's spiritual faultings and was serving Vyasadeva and very happy, and as a result, Vidura was born. So these are three important personalities. And of course, I mean, I can't tell the whole story, but from Duryodhana, there were how many sons born? 101 sons. And how many daughters? One daughter. Dushala was born. And Dushala married Jayadrath. And so that was from Duryodhana. And from Pandu, he really didn't have any direct sons because he was actually cursed because he had killed the Rishi who had taken the form of a deer, the Rishi Kindapa. And so his children came through the interaction of his wife Kunti Devi with the different demigods. So how many children were there? Five. But Kunti had had... two from Madri. Sorry. Two from Madri because she called the Ashwini Kumaras. But Pandu actually had five. They were considered Pandu's five children. They were called the Pandavas. And they were actually the expansions of the demigods. Actually great pure devotees, too, who were empowered by different demigods. So those are the good guys, the Pandavas. And then the bad guys are... Duryodhana and his brothers, particularly Duryodhana, Dushasana, and others. So that's how, this is how things lined up before the battle of Kurukshetra. There's so many other stories, but we don't have time to tell. So any questions or comments? Yes. Agrishikesh.
Guru, there were two incidents, like, you know, Ganges came through Bhagirathi also.
Yeah.
Ganges came this way also. So is it related?
Well, the Ganges was already there. Eons before... The Gangadevi was seen by Shantanu. this whole story of the descent of the Ganges came. And that was Bhagirath who performed austerities to bring the Ganges down. And Ganges is also called Janavi, because the sage Jana one time swallowed her. Anyway, he let her out. But so the Ganges was already there 5,000 years ago. And that happened millions of years before that was the descent of the Ganges. That story is also there in the Mahabharata and in the Ramayana too.
So then Ganges came along with Ganga.
The Ganges was already, the river was already there, and Ganga Devi is the personification of that river, but she hadn't taken birth on the earth before. She was always a demigod. Demigoddess, sorry. But sometimes demigoddesses and demigods are cursed to take human form. And the way you can tell the difference, if you ever run into one, is that demigods don't touch the earth and they don't sweat. You know, so if you see someone sweating, they're not a demigod. Or if they're touching the earth, they're not a demigod. Whereas human beings touch the earth and they sweat. So that's really, sometimes it looks very, they look very similar. I don't know if you've ever had that experience. But you know, Ganga Devi took a human form to have a relationship with a Shantanu. So normally she has a demigod, she's pure demigoddess. But sometimes she takes a human form, and this is a particular case, she came and took a human form to have a relationship with Shantanu. Is that alright? Yeah.
Also, like when Vyasadeva first came, when his mother Satyavati called him, he told her that they should, the two girls needed to go through, they should wait a year to go through a purification, because he knew that they wouldn't be able to bear his form at this point.
Yeah.
But she was so impatient, like, you know, it had to be done then, because she didn't wait. And
that's right. Yeah, because she didn't wait. She didn't follow Vyasadeva's instructions. She said, no, no, now. And he just said, well, you're going to have to deal with the repercussions of this whole thing. He knew what was going to happen. I mean, Vyasadeva is Srikala Gya. He could see the future. He knew. You know, sometimes you see the future and you try to prevent it happening, but it happens anyway. So he knew what was going to happen. I mean, Vyasadeva is... And then considered the literary incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He compiled the Vedic literatures. Anyway, interesting story. Any other questions? Yes.
You mentioned that Dwarpara and Kali, or demigods, who took birth as Shakuni.
Yeah.
So was that part of the strategy to...
Of Krishna, yeah. Yeah, yeah, to get the demons all riled up. Because you need people just like Shakuni was very instrumental in riling up Duryodhana. I mean, he was essential. He's an essential part of the whole plot. And giving him all these different strategies to kill the Pandavas, like the House of Lack came from Shakuni. Practically every strategy, killing Bhishma with a poison, you know, poison cake, throwing him in the river, everything, practically every, all the plots on that side came from Shakuni. Like that. Yeah, and of course, Dhritarashtra was also blind spiritually, morally, and physically. I mean, that's another point too. And when Duryodhana was born, this is one other story. Anyway, when Duryodhana was born, he brayed like an ass instead of cried like a baby. And Vidura understood that this was going to be the cause of destruction of the whole dynasty. So Vidura said, you know, at least send this kid out for adoption, you know. You know, put on the internet or something. Foster parents or something. Because he knew what was going to happen. There were all the signs, like meteors were going through the sky at the same time. And different animals were making strange noises. And Vidura, because there are signs by which you can ascertain what's going to happen in the future. And Vidura just advised him, but Dhritarashtra was so attached, it's my son. But you have 99 others. But he was so attached that he didn't give him up at that point. And it was Dhritarashtra's attachment. Actually, Duryodhana represented Dhritarashtra's envy towards his brother, Pandu, because Pandu could take the kingdom, or had the kingdom before, even though he was the younger brother, because Dhritarashtra was blind. And in those days, a king could not be blind, because a king had to be the one who was at the forefront of his army. In that way, less wars were fought. You know, if you told the president of the United States, all right, you want to fight a war here, you know, that George Bush, go back to the past president. I know it's not George Bush anymore. But let's say you're talking about, you know, Iraq. Okay, suit up. Here's your tank, you know. Or, you know, you say, well, maybe we should think twice about that war. Isn't it? Because he wasn't a real Kshatriya. But a real Kshatriya actually enjoys that sort of thing. I mean, I was just reading a little bit about Christian history about King Constantine. I mean, he wanted to become the king of the whole Roman Empire. So he marched from what we call the UK and France nowadays, all the way to Rome, conquered that, and then marched to the Eastern Empire, you know, which is now called Constantinople and everything like that. So, but that's a Kshatriya. That's Kshatriya's spirit. But nowadays, the leaders are not really Kshatriyas anymore. I'm not pointing out any particular leader. Usually they're Vaishyas or Shudras, which means, you know, they may have good intention, but not the intelligence to understand how to deal with things. Or the Vaishyas. I mean, you find many leaders, not in America, of course, who salt away money in Swiss bank accounts. And recently, I think even in, it was, anyway, recently, of course, the United States has demanded that Swiss bank accounts become transparent. And there's no more secret Swiss bank accounts. I hate to disappoint you in that. So anyway, so that's the Kshatriya mentality. Okay, any other questions or comments? I mean, it's interesting. The Mahabharata war is very interesting from different angles of vision. The main thing, as I was pointing out, is Krishna's enjoying these different exchanges. Krishna's enjoying, and he's also entertaining us who will become attracted to him. Because that's another purpose that I left out, unfortunately. Because unless Krishna comes down and demonstrates his nature, how are we going to become attracted to him? I mean, we can say love God, love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy might, with all thy soul, millions of times. But what does it mean? I mean, do you love him because of what? Yes, the most you can do is I love you because of what you give me. Like, you know, I love getting toys at Christmas. I really love my parents at that time of year, more than any other time of the year. The rest of the year, you know, I could either take them or leave them. So that's the most you can do if you don't know the nature of God. Is because what he gives, you know, I appreciate. It can be appreciation, yes. I appreciate God has given me opportunity, he's given me education, he's given me the food, he's given me this, given me that. Okay, I appreciate God. But to really, that's not love, that's still business. I love you because of what you do for me. You know, appreciation is still business exchange. But to love someone for who they are, not what they do for you, that is love. You know, I love you no matter what you do to me, for me. You know, then that's, of course, the epitome that's mentioned in the final verse of the Shikshashtika by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Now, Krishna, you may crush me by your embrace, you may leave me brokenhearted by not being present before me, but you're completely free to do anything and everything. So that's love. And that can only be attained when you get to know someone. And that you get to know someone by the process of bhakti yoga, which is you chant his names, you hear about the Mahabharata, Krishna's heroic act, Mamavirya Sambhadaha, Krishna's heroic activities, Krishna's romantic activities, Krishna's tricky activities, Krishna's humorous activities. Then you get to love him. He's quite lovable. And interesting, too, he's never boring. That's one thing about Krishna. You're never bored with him. You don't know what to expect next. Especially when you go back to God, it gets even less boring. You know, Krishna, God knows what he does. And even his expansion is Ananta Shesh can't understand him. Yeah.
All those demons who were killed in Mahabharata.
Yeah.
Where did they go? They came back again, Kali Yuga?
Some of them, because they were killed in the presence of Krishna, they actually got liberated. And some of them went to the heavenly planets. There's different versions of the Mahabharata. I mean, it's quite fortunate to be killed in the presence of Krishna. So they actually got benedicted. I mean, practically everybody got benedicted. Even, you know, Karna, whatever, they all got benedicted by the occurrence of the Mahabharata. It wasn't just like killing. It was blessing at the same time. They got elevated. Everyone got elevated. And Grandfather Bhishma, he got to preach the most amazing philosophy while he was lying on the bed of arrows at the end. Krishna arranged that he wouldn't feel any pain. I mean, he had already had the benediction from his father, Shantanu, that he wouldn't die unless he wanted to. But he didn't have the benediction that he wouldn't feel pain. So in the beginning, his mind really wasn't clear, and he was actually feeling a lot of pain. He actually asked Arjuna to provide water in the beginning, and Arjuna did that with the arrow. He shot down, and the Ganges came out of the earth planet and gave him some water. But he was experiencing pain, so Krishna blessed him that he wouldn't feel any pain. So he was able to speak very concisely about moral philosophy, you know, how to be a proper king, I mean, Niti Shastra, so many things Bhishma spoke about, and ultimately about devotion to Krishna, and ultimately he was able to fix his eyes upon Krishna's lotus feet and lotus face when he left this world. So, I mean, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? I mean, his death is just amazing. Simply amazing. We sometimes compare it to Haridas Thakur's passing away. So, I guess it's time. We don't want to go on forever. I do have a lot more information. Yeah?
Isn't it generally understood that when a demon is killed in the presence of the Lord, that the liberation that he achieves is Sayuja?
Yeah.
So, how is that considered a benediction? Because the devotee considers that hell.
Hell yeah. Well, he becomes... Here's the point. When we talk about liberation, he becomes free from all past karma. And when you're free from all past karma, then you get an opportunity if you want to take devotional service. So that's part of that Sayuja liberation, that you're free. Just like we talk about when someone pulls a let's not even talk about the Bharati Acharya. Let's talk about like all your family members, you know, past, present, future, get liberated. Doesn't mean they all go back to Godhead. It means they get free from karma and get the opportunity to perform devotional service. Because one actually has to want to be a devotee. You can't take some people kicking and screaming back to the spiritual world. You know, if I told my mother, you know, you're going back to the spiritual world, whether you like it or not, I don't know if she would agree right now. We're working on it. But she wouldn't agree right now. So basically, the word liberation is understood according to the context, but what you're saying is true. It's a usual liberation. Usually, it's not back to God. But that's also better than being an out-and-out demon. You know, and many of them, like they went back to their, like you take, Kali and Shakuni and Duryodhana, they went back to their position in the heavenly planets, and then Kali had to get back to work very soon after the Mahabharata war. Because it's his yuga, right? So he has that service. Somehow or other, he has that service to perform. He's considered, at least in the Mahabharata, he's considered a demigod. That he stirs things up. But there's one good point about Kali Yuga. What's the good point about Kali Yuga? Yeah. Kirtana Deva Krishna Shah Mukta Sangha Parambajet. Simply by chanting Hare Krishna, one can go back to God. You don't have to become a complicated Vedic ritual guy or anything like that, or do horse sacrifices or whatever sacrifices you want to do. You just chant the Lord's holy names and distribute Bhagavad Gita as an advertisement for you. Because that's chanting also. That chanting is called the Brihat Murdanga. So if you distribute a Gita and someone reads it, it's like you've chanted the whole Gita to them. You get the benefit. Any one book is shared by many, many people. So you get the benefit of all that chanting in the Bhagavad Gita. It's amazing, isn't it? Because you can chant by yourself, that's all right. But if you chant congregationally, that's called Sankirtan, then it actually is much more beneficial for everybody, including yourself. think we have to end. I hope it's warm enough outside for the prasadam. So thank you. I want to thank everybody for coming in spite of the inclement weather. We'll see everybody next week. It'll be nice weather next week by Krishna's grace, maybe. So we can have a very nice Kita Jayanti ceremony, which will consist of fire sacrifice, reading the Bhagavad Gita. Just Sanskrit, no English? Sanskrit. It'd be good to have... We've done before Sanskrit and English. If someone is real quick, you can do the whole Gita in 3.5 to 4 hours in both languages. Yeah, I've done the whole Bhagavad Gita in 3.5 hours.
If you start at 2 o'clock, we don't need Sanskrit. Yeah.
Oh.
You won't have enough time.
Or you can have someone do it in two groups or something. I mean, you figure it out, because there's a lot of people who won't understand Sanskrit.
We have almost 4 hours. We're starting at noon, so up to 4.
Oh, yeah, 4 hours. In 4 hours, you can definitely do Sanskrit and English. I've done the whole Gita, Sanskrit, and English in 2.5 hours.
You should just read all together, not one by one.
Yeah, you have to, he'll let him organize it. I mean, I have one disciple who chants the whole Bhagavad Gita every day in an hour. You know who that is, Narottam.
Or if you just chant Chatur
Sloki. But yes, it's very auspicious to chant the whole Gita, and then we can have. Anyway, you arrange. You arrange. I'm not in charge. I just work for you. So, I guess on that happy note, we'll all take prasadam. All glories to His divine grace. Shilabrabha.